Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What do American children need to know, and is our system of public education adequately equipped to teach it to them? As the Obama administration considers changes to the No Child Left Behind law of 2002, educators continue to debate its merits. As a key player in crafting the original measure, former U.S. Secretary of Education Margaret Spellings believes that for all the controversy surrounding it, NCLB has been an invaluable step forward in gaining a clear understanding of students' performance and in holding their schools and their teachers accountable. Margaret Spellings is currently working as a public policy strategist. She's in Dallas to accept the Luminary Award for Education Reform tonight from SMU's Simmons School of Education and Human Development. Margaret, welcome to Think.
Thanks, Chris. Thrilled to be here.
You famously said in 2006 that NCLB was 99% pure like ivory soap, didn't need much amendment. Do you have the same opinion today?
Well, I do, because the core principles of No Child Left Behind, transparency, accountability, focusing on great teachers, options and information for parents, a focus on reading, are all still absolutely the very right elements for us to be working on in a public policy sort of sense. Now, are there changes and improvements that can be made to the law, you know, 8 years in? Have we learned some things in the field? You bet. But those core principles are the right ones, and I stand by them as much today as when they were written.
Talk about what we understand today about what our students know, where they're lacking, that we couldn't really accurately measure before No Child Left Behind.
Well, that is a great question, and really we have tons more information than we ever have before. You know, I like to say that our federal strategy before No Child Left Behind was that we put the money out and hoped for the best. Most states had snapshot sort of accountability systems where they tested the kids, you know, once in elementary school, once in middle school, and once in high school, if that much. Often the data was not disaggregated. In other words, we just threw it all and were proud of ourselves for the averages. That's how lots of kids get, you know, quote unquote, left behind, if you will. And so today, with annual assessment, disaggregated data, a requirement that every single state of our 50 states have a system like that, we know so much more. Likewise, we also called on every state to participate in our National Education Report Card before President Bush and I went to D.C. It was about, you know, 30 or so states, and it was a 30 different states every year. So we sort of had a moving target in that respect as well. So we really have framed the problem in very stark, accurate, and I believe actionable ways so we can get to work at what we need to, what's chronically broken and needs our greatest attention, and where we're doing well.
We still see a really distressing achievement gap between white American students and African American and Latino students. What accounts for that?
Well, a variety of things, and not the least of which, before No Child Left Behind, is you know, when you throw all their scores together and look at the averages, they get lost in the shuffle. The president used to talk about, you know, moving kids through the system, what he called the soft bigotry of low expectations. And, you know, I think that sort of phenomenon continues, sadly, to be alive and well. But this law says, you know, those kids matter independently and as a group, as a population, and we have to attend to their needs. That's why our National Education Report Card shows the greatest gains for our minority and special ed students, even while we're beginning to close the achievement gap.
Another widely circulated criticism is the fact that while we have registered some substantial gains for elementary and middle school students, by the time they're 17, there seems to be a backslide to the extent that there's about a 3 years' worth difference between white students and African-American students. What goes into that figure that can explain why they've gained all this ground and then suddenly at 17 they seem to be not testing well?
Well, a couple of things I would say. One is, and those are the ones that remain in the system by 17.
As opposed to dropping out.
Okay, so lots of the troubled kids, the left behind kids, are not even there. So it's probably, in actuality, even worse than that. But my own theory about that is the power of accountability, the power of this law, is in our elementary and middle schools. Every single year from grades 3 through 8, we focus like a laser on annual assessment and achievement for every single child. In this law, No Child Left Behind, we require assessment one time in high school. And it varies widely among the states. Some people do it as some states do it as an exit exam at 10th or 11th grade. Sometimes it's an end of course exam, a variety of things. So frankly, we don't have that power of accountability on high school. And I would suggest that if we did, we'd start to see more attending to that problem.
Did you consider writing it into the original measure?
Well, we knew that we had a long way to go to get to that 3 through 8 assessment. When President Bush and I showed up in Washington, about 8 or 9 states had annual assessment and disaggregated accountability systems. Some states didn't even have standards. So to get to a 50-state program that had even that much accountability was a huge step forward. And frankly, in education policy, done basically at lightning pace. So we knew that we had to start with an emphasis on our early and middle schools and then add accountability and add a focus on high schools. And I'm proud that people like the Gates Foundation, among others, are talking about high schools, college readiness. The National Governors Association has talked a lot about it. So there's a growing head of steam around those issues.
One of the goals of No Child Left Behind is by 2014 to see that every American student is performing at grade level. First of all, how do you decide what's an appropriate level of achievement based on the grade that a student's in?
Well, the way that that's framed in the law now is that every state, each individual state, decides, you know, what is grade level, what the standards are, how high they are, what constitutes passage on those states. And so it's a little bit of a crazy quilt of standards. And some in the education policy arena, including the Obama administration, have talked about our need to have national standards. I don't happen to agree with them, which we can talk about.
Nor does the state of Texas.
Nor does the state of Texas. And we'll talk about the implications of that. But I think that's part of the problem, is that, you know, there's a variety of standards and so forth.
We have seen a third of U.S. states reduce what they consider to be proficiency at different grade levels. That's got to be, does that feel to you like a loophole, a golden loophole, or is that maybe an appropriate readjustment of the curriculum and the standard?
No, I think it's it is a reaction to the power of accountability. I mean, when we start to peel the onion, people, especially, you know, mostly grown-ups, get uncomfortable. I mean, if we as a country, we as educators are not uncomfortable that half of our Hispanic and African-American kids are getting out of high school on time, you know, shame on us. We ought to be uncomfortable about that. And so that kind of stark truth, I think, causes educators and systems and public policy officials, politicians, to think, oh, my God, we can't expose that much that soon. And you start to see these sort of unintended consequences of lowering the bar, lowering cut scores for what passage is, and on and on.
Do you think that those states should not be permitted to change their standards in order to sort of, at least by the letter of things, qualify for No Child Left Behind?
Well, I mean, that's a complicated question. And the first thing is, I'll say, and having, you know, obviously worked at the state level, and in particular this state, the Great Lone Star State, you know, you have to kind of start where you are. I mean, Texas has been a pioneer and a leader in the accountability movement since the mid-'80s when I showed up, and when Ross Perot and Mark White and, you know, the whole House Bill 72, no pass, no play, all of those sorts of things. But we were looking at real assessment even then. It was a snapshot type system, but remember, this is the mid-'80s. And so we've been a pioneer and have continued to be a pioneer. And, you know, I think you have to start where you are. I mean, let's pretend like you were trying to lose weight. Would you say, you know, I'm going to lose 100 pounds? No, you'd say you were going to lose 10 pounds, and then you'd lose another 10 pounds. And you have to sort of, you know, accommodate the system over time. You've got to build public support along the way. You know, there's no way we can have a system that says every school in our state stinks. So, and just politically, with parents, with the kind of issue that public education is, it's just not practical. So let's start where we are, and let's raise the bar over time. And that's what Texas has done, and that's what states ought to continue to do. But you have to recognize the reality of the current system as well. So it's a happy medium.
So 48 U.S. states, the holdouts being Alaska and Texas, have come together and said we should consider what a common standard might be and create something that will be pretty equal across the board. What do you think is the drawback to that?
Well, the first thing, I'm a little skeptical that the same people who led us to the bottom are now suddenly going to race to the top. And so, you know, I want to believe, I really do, but, you know, I reject the fact that the reason we haven't been able to get kids on grade level on basically fairly low bars around the country is because the standards weren't high. I mean, I'm the person that has defended against, you know, an over-labeling of schools as failures, too much teaching to the test, all of these sorts of things that now suddenly when we say, well, we're gonna jump, 10 feet higher, that suddenly that will not have the same consequences. So I really worry that this standards discussion is a way to change the subject. We have 50 speedometers, if you will, in this country that say we are going too slow. So what are we going to do? Get a new speedometer. We need to be talking about how we're going to speed up.
Wouldn't it be helpful, though, for as a sort of objective measure of how Mississippi is doing as compared to Kansas, if they were both looking at the same question?
You know, we have that. It's called the National Assessment of Educational Progress, known as the Nation's Education Report Card. And I'm sitting here looking at a document right now that basically has, from top to bottom, how states compare to their standards compared to the NAEP. So I can tell you right now today that Massachusetts has way better standards than Utah, that has not so good ones in the fourth grade, and this is reading. So, I mean, we already have an indicator that informs us of that, and we ought to, I mean, what we called for during my days is that parents ought to know that. And let's start with disclosure. Let's start with the idea that the people who care most about their kids are those that are closest to them and those that are paying the bills. And those are parents and states.
And the NAEP works out. It's a representative sample of kids from across the country.
It
is.
It's about 300,000 students across the country. You know, we have 50 million plus students in schools. And so it's like taking a poll, if you will. It gives us a really good indicator, but it doesn't, it's not a test that can be taught to. So making it an even better indicator of where we are.
Let's talk about this question of teaching to the test, because I'm sure the phones will light up after the next segment and people will want to talk about this. There are people who believe, as you do, that if you're teaching students adequately, there's no special preparation save teaching kids how to fill in the bubble properly. And there are other people who say it's simply impossible to get kids to do well on these tests without a lot of coaching specific to the test.
Well, I mean, a couple of things I would note. First of all, you know, teaching to the test is not unsound educational practice. I mean, if the test is measuring the curriculum you want the students to know, so let's pretend like we're going to teach fractions. And if the test is on fractions and the curriculum is on fractions, essentially you want to teach to the test, if you will. And that is completely appropriate. You can't, on subjects like reading or social studies, I mean, the ability to read, I mean, how would you teach to the test on a skill like reading? You can either read or you can't. So, you know, I think some of this is, you know, gets a little, it's a little bit red herring type issues to avoid what we're really talking about, and that's accountability. It's a way to kind of stir up emotion around and divert us from our need to close the achievement gap. So, you know, I hear it a lot. You're right. But if the test is good and the curriculum is sound, then there's nothing wrong with it. Now, having said that, you know, is it appropriate to have a better rounded set of indicators? Yes. We, you know, as I told you when we started visiting, you know, we have come light years and in less than a decade on accountability. And now we have, let's say, junior high accountability in our schools. And we need to go to college level accountability and PhD level accountability. And when I say that, I mean assessment that is more facile, that is more technological, that is more timely so that there's instant feedback for teachers, assessment that's more actionable. I mean, we can do a better job of making measurement more seamless, more customer friendly, and so on. And that's what we should do. But there's not a thing wrong with testing.
Former U.S. Secretary of Education Margaret Spellings is my guest. She's in town to receive the Luminary Award tonight from SMU's Simmons School of Education and Human Development. You can join our conversation now by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can make your passion your career. Evening classes are now available in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is former U.S. Secretary of Education Margaret Spellings, who is currently working as a public policy strategist. She's in town to receive the Luminary Award tonight from SMU's Simmons School of Education and Human Development. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Margaret, how do you define a highly qualified teacher?
Well, how I define a highly qualified teacher is somebody who gets results with kids. Are the people who do the very best work at getting growth for a child academically in a year-long period of time. Oftentimes we've looked at, and certainly No Child Left Behind is guilty of this, looked at inputs. I mean, how many hours of professional development the teacher has, how many degrees the teacher has, all of those sorts of things. And they're not unimportant values, no doubt about that. But the most important thing is, can the teacher move the needle with the student?
And is testing alone adequate to evaluate that? In other words, if we can't just look at inputs, are the test results of students, particularly in schools where you have a lot more kids struggling than in other schools, is it enough to look at how the scores are changing year to year?
Well, I think one of the things that we can do is find better ways to look at test data. As I told you, the reason that we had the kind of accountability system we have in No Child Left Behind is because we didn't have annual assessment anywhere. So you couldn't look at, how much progress was made year on year. So now that we have that kind of information, instead of just shooting towards an absolute standard, we can look at how much growth, how much progress a teacher has made with the child. You can, accommodate where the child begins, if you will, and give educators credit for that progress that they're making over time. A more sophisticated way to look at accountability, as I said, we've been in junior high, we need to go to high school and college when we think about accountability. So we can use data better in more sophisticated ways. But also, I have to say, one of the things that we've done with No Child Left Behind is use assessment data for accountability purposes, to let parents have options for tutoring, to let parents know where their kids stand relative to others in a city and have options to access other public schools and charter schools and the like. And so if you're going to use assessment for consequences, it has to be valid and reliable and sound and fair. And to look at other dimensions, all of them good and fine and appropriate, grade books, parent surveys, those sorts of things, they just are not necessary. They're more subjective. And you can't, people would be howling about unfair systems if we went to approaches that relied too much on more fungible indicators.
Can you talk a minute about how fine the grain is of the results that come back to the schools? In other words, can you drill down to the extent that you say, okay, the teacher in this fourth grade classroom, her kids consistently from year to year struggle with subject-verb agreement more than the kids across the hall, but across the hall they can't multiply fractions. Are you able to get that fine?
We're getting there. Not yet. Actually, the short answer of that is it really varies by state. And that's what I say. We need much more sophisticated systems and much more timely systems. I mean, the fact that, Ms. Smith knows that last year's kids, had deficiencies in fractions over long division, that doesn't do that much good for Ms. Smith this year with this year's kids. And so more continuous reporting, better data, more timely. I think what we're going to here is ways to use the power of accountability to improve the system, to help teachers do a better job. And I think we're seeing an adapting process by grown-ups. Managers and teachers, I've seen it a million times, they get the aha moment that, man, I can do my job better if I know more about the kids.
Have teachers' unions been a help or a hindrance in trying to make this system work?
Well, I would say a little of both. And, I respect that. They represent teachers. They represent the interest of the adults in the system. And that's what they're supposed to do. That's what they're paid to do. I think the AFT, particularly here in Texas, has been very forward-leaning on things like, research-based reading instruction and helping teachers do a better job in that way. But I think there's a lot of fear by teachers as to how these things get used with respect to their own evaluation and performance. And I think that provokes anxiety, and I understand that. We all, resist accountability.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. The email address is think@kera.org. Let's go to Terry in Dallas. Hey, Terry.
Hi. First of all, I just want to say thank you, Chris, for a wonderful program, a longtime listener.
Thank you.
And to you, Madam Secretary, thank you for your work in education. I come from a family of educators, all the way back to my great-grandmother. And, you know, I'm a teacher now. And one of the things that I heard you say that I'd like to hear your feedback on is, you know, because I hear this a lot, too, because I do consultant work as well, and I'm mostly a teacher of writing. One of the things that I hear is, well, you know, the whole dichotomy of, you know, teaching to the test versus not teaching to the test. And yes, I do believe that if you are teaching well, then the kids will get what they need. But one thing you mentioned was, you know, either you can read or you can't. And kind of what I've seen when we switched over from TOS to TEX in Texas is that I had kids when I taught in Dallas that passed the reading test, and they eked on by. They didn't, like, pass with flying colors, but they could not read. I mean, because we know reading is more than just word calling or being able to summarize. It's actually being able to extrapolate that information and do something with it. So I'd like to hear feedback on that, but I'd also like to hear feedback on, you know, more inquiry-based, authentic learning that happens more through those, kind of what John McKenzie talks about and what the quality school Dr. Miller talks about, with just really starting with those student-led essential questions. And I'd love to hear your answer to that.
Thanks for your call. Well, first of all, thank you for your commitment to education. Thank you for teaching and for your emphasis on writing. That's all great. And just a quick comment about the reading thing you mentioned, which you're right. You're absolutely right. It does get more complex in terms of vocabulary, comprehension, you know, synthesis, and all of those sorts of things. And so that's why it's important that we moved from the TOS test to TAX. And now, of course, there'll be another generation of Texas tests that will raise the bar further. And so that we need to keep raising that standard. It's important. So it's, you're right, it's not that simple. On the issue of, you know, different skills and different assessments and authentic learning and those sorts of things, I mean, I think those are fine and dandy. We have not yet perfected the ways that we would measure, that we would understand that and use it for accountability purposes. And I think we're in the process of doing that. I mean, the assessment industry, psychometrics, and applications in education really are still in the early days, in my opinion. And we can do more. We should do more. And I think we're going to see with the Race to the Top funds, they're talking a lot about the use of formative assessment, more regular feedback, technology-based assessment systems, all those sorts of things that are going to be more transparent to the kid, more helpful to the educator, and potentially at higher levels. But we are not yet there.
Are there things that U.S. schools tend to be spending time on that really don't contribute to the intellectual bottom line?
Well, sure. There's a lot of, I think teachers, you know, I hear teachers say this a lot, too. There's a lot of sort of, you know, management stuff that is just the necessary evil of you know, organizing a bunch of kids together and paperwork and assemblies and those sorts of things. But I think, you know, we mostly get a lot out of the school day. Sure, there's some waste, but I think, you know, educators do the very best job they can with the time allotted. I do think we're learning, and again, this is where the assessment feedback really helps us be more customized as we educate kids. Some kids are going to need more time than the traditional six-hour day. Some kids are going to need summer school or after school or weekend or evening or whatever. And we have yet to do a really very good job of kind of customizing education for kids. But we're on the eve of doing that.
Well, it is interesting that with the exception of some charter schools that are doing really different things with the schedule of the day, as you say, we are sort of locked into the six-hour school day, and yet more and more schools are giving great amounts of homework, sort of bolstering things. Does it make sense to consider maybe an eight-hour school day that doesn't require kids to be home working on a diorama or something?
You know, I think over time it does. I mean, I really do. I think we're in the middle of and why I'm very excited about education. And one of the things that, I mean, my little soapbox is we haven't really gotten as serious as we need to get. We Americans don't have the sense of urgency that we ought to have around this issue, because we think about the policy things that we've done kind of around the edges, but we have not really tackled how to use time and how to use people. And there is no enterprise in the world that can, you know, make dramatic improvement without doing the very best job of using time and people. And we're not doing that. And we have to be as customized about schooling as we are about pretty much everything else in our lives, whether it's buying a pair of glasses or a cup of coffee. Now, I know this is way more complicated than that, but think about, you know, the kind of approaches that we have in healthcare or, you know, any myriad of things. So
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is former U.S. Secretary of Education Margaret Spellings. Let's go next to Wichita Falls, where we'll speak with Natalie. Hi, Natalie.
Hello. Yes, Chris, another wonderful show.
Yes,
two more guests there, Secretary Spellings, please. What are your thoughts about shortening the school vacation to 1 month each year? Of course, you know, accounting for bad weather days and the holidays. Your thoughts on that? I ask that because wouldn't that be a way of providing more jobs to teachers so that those who will need some time away to, again, prepare for another semester can do so and employ some more full-time teachers to, let's say, take up slack for half a year. And I appreciate your thoughts on all of that. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, Natalie, I think if we were sitting here 10 or 20 years from now, we would see a whole lot of different models that we don't see today. Right now, the school year across this country, as you know, is September to May. Largely, it's about 185 days. It's about 6 hours a day, and there you have it. And those are the givens in American education policy today. And I think what we're really changing is, you know, more customization, more adaptation to our modern world, to modern families, to a modern teacher corps, and on and on and on. We're going to see education that is more competency-based than seat time-based. So some kids are going to need less than 185 days to get the material that they ought to have in the third grade and graduate and move on to the fourth grade. And some kids are going to need more than 185 days. And we're going to need to have to allocate our teacher personnel around those needs. And it's going to look different in ways like the one you described and many other models.
At least in the current scenario, for middle-class kids and upper-middle-class kids, there's the ability of parents to enhance that with music lessons after school, with dance, with sports, with camps in the summertime.
Which
is great, but there are a lot of families that can't afford that. Is it possible in the public school system to fully level the playing field without regard to a student's socioeconomic background?
Well, I don't think you can fully level it, but we can do a much better job, and I think technology can help us do that. And I think we're getting there, too. I mean, this is really a very exciting, I say this probably about every decade, but this is a very exciting time in American public education because we've peeled the onion. We know where we are. The data is screaming at us to do some different things. And I think that we're beginning to get more serious about that. Technological-based programs, mentoring programs. I mean, there are things that we can do. You know, my friend Joel Klein, who's the chancellor of the New York schools for Mayor Bloomberg, we talk about this a lot where, you know, people think, well, if only you'd send us, you know, kids who come from, you know, higher income families and have lots of social services support and on and on and on, then we could do the job in education. Really, Joel and I think about it the opposite. You know, the education system is the very best game changer to really break that cycle of poverty. And when we educate an American and a human being, you know, that's the ticket to the American dream and to really a whole new look at capacity, human resource development in our country.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also get to us via email to think@kera.org. We'll go next to Plano and speak with Frank. Hi, Frank.
Hello. Yes,
hi, Frank.
I actually met Secretary Spellings when she went by the name La Montaigne in Austin when she worked for then-Governor Bush. I'm a former textbook publisher. I used to run Saxon Publishers, but my basic deal was the message I was delivering then was trying to look at the results that the use of textbooks produce, tying them to the test scores, because one thing that I saw that was very disturbing in the textbook publishing industry is the publishers all produce books that look interchangeable. They're all kind of very bland, lacking personality, and that's just because of the process that we go through for selecting them, that they're just very careful about. They have to be very politically correct. They can't offend any particular groups. They have to, and so it's not so much about producing results as meeting, you know, meeting the requirements of a checklist. So, you know, my advice would be, you know, let the forces of the marketplace take over. Let the different publishers produce books of different with different approaches, and then look at the results afterwards. I think the Bush administration did part of that with the What Works, you know, clearinghouse, because a big driver of education are the textbooks, and it seems like that's kind of absent from the equation.
That's a really interesting point, Frank. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, that's a great point, Frank, and thank you for your good work on Saxon, and obviously you all have come on around the country in major ways, and I'm glad to know that you're still on the battlefield, if you will, in education. You're right, and as you know, and for the rest of the listeners, I mean, Texas is a major influencer of textbook content because we are obviously a major purchaser and have a very, you know, elaborated, truncated process through our State Board of Education, which ultimately results in books that are, you know, an inch deep and a mile wide. I mean, they are all over the board. And part of, I think, a teacher's frustration in trying to cover the curriculum while accommodating the standards and move the needle on accountability, if you will, is sort of the burden, the hurdle, that often the textbook provides. So I agree with you, Frank, and I think, you know, the What Works Clearinghouse, a better alignment between, you know, instruction and materials, a simplification. This is one of the things that I do like about the national standards debate. Certainly it's not you can do this in ways other than a federal program where we have fewer, clearer, higher standards that are the target that are, and, you know, some of the rest of this stuff falls away. Some of the checklist stuff about, you know, all of this. We are in the information age, as we all know. All of that stuff's available on the Internet, and, you know, we need to let our teachers do what they do.
Former U.S. Secretary of Education Margaret Spellings is my guest, in town to receive the Luminary Award from SMU School of Education and Human Development. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can make your passion your career. Evening classes are now available in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is former U.S. Secretary of Education Margaret Spellings. She's in town to receive the Luminary Award from SMU's Simmons School of Education and Human Development. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. We have an email here from Bill who says, please comment on the perception that for the more gifted child, This school tends to look like a place where I have to wait for the less gifted. I mean, in other words, I guess, are we serving our brightest students to the fullest extent of our ability?
I'm glad that he asked that because, you know, I hear that a lot. I do. And that's, you know, regrettable. But I'll tell you what, it just is not showing up in the data. I mean, achievement is up across the board. At the 90th percentile, we're moving up. At the 80th, at the 70th, you know, and on and on. And, you know, yes, we're paying more attention to our, you know, previously way underserved kids, but it really has not been at the expense of our gifted kids. Now, you know, can and should local school districts attend to and be creative and find ways and have AP and IB and all sorts of offerings that address that population? You bet, because those are our, you know, our innovators and our engineers and our, you know, the people who are going to lead us forward. But so are the kids that have been previously left behind. And the federal government's role, since LBJ, another famous Texan, really created it, more than 40 years ago, has been around the needs of minority kids and our disadvantaged population, special ed kids. And that is the mission of the federal government to the extent that there is a mission. And so, you know, average kids, gifted kids, all need to be challenged and attended to. And I'm glad that it's not showing up in any kind of degradation in the data, because it's just not.
What can we learn from the other countries that seem to be besting us on test scores year in and year out?
Well, I think we can learn a lot. And in my days as the U.S. Secretary of Education, I had the opportunity to travel all over the world. I led, you know, university president delegations and lots of other, you know, bilateral meetings and so forth with my colleagues from around the world. And I will tell you a couple things. One is more anecdotal and one is research-based. The anecdotal one is that our competitors are highly motivated to achieve. And it is engendered in the culture. Parents make it a priority in amazing ways. In fact, some would say, you know, in with too much intensity than we do in the U.S. But, you know, it's I think the Americans underappreciate the kinds of opportunities that are available to them in their public schools, opportunities that people around the world would, you know, kill for. And so we take it for granted. And just the drive, the motivation that you see around the world, I often don't think we have here. We talk about things like class size and inputs and pay and self-esteem and obesity and all of those things that are important. But, you know, they seem to be overshadowing, you know, how are the kids doing? And as I said, you know, with half our minority kids getting out of high school on time, that's sort of shameful. Okay, so that's the anecdote. On the more empirical side, you know, as I said, they have curriculums that are less wide and deeper. You know, if we have a mile wide and an inch deep, they have reached very high proficiency levels at a more limited number of skills, the most fundamental basic skills in mathematics and in reading and in science and across the curriculum. But they do a few things and they do them well.
Can we say that an American child has had a top-notch education if there's been no art or music in the curriculum?
As a parent of a school child, I wouldn't say that. I really wouldn't say that. But I don't think it's an either or. And I think we Americans, we parents, we taxpayers ought to reject the idea that our schools are not able to teach our kids to read and cipher while doing some other things, too, while having recess, while having music, art, and on and on. And yes, there are budgetary implications. And that's why parents need to go to their school boards and say, you know what? You know, a tax increase for these extra things, for gifted and talented programs, for more AP, it, you know, is perfectly fine and dandy with me. And so, you know, I think that's where we calibrate the role between the federal government and the state government and local communities.
It is extraordinary that historically nobody votes in, or very few people vote in, school board elections, which have more to do with our property taxes than anything else that we pay for.
Absolutely. I used to work for the Texas Association of School Boards, and I often said that, you know, school boards are dealing with the two most important things to most people, your child and most of your taxes. And so, you know, I hope people will take this as a call to arms to pay more attention to their school boards and those elections.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Irving and speak with Dorothy. Hi, Dorothy.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I want to ask Margaret. I'm a longtime educator, and I am concerned that the focus of standardized testing is on the cultural experience of the angle and it doesn't reflect the cultural experience of the African American or the Hispanic. It's not the educational ability. It's their cultural experience. And I'll take my answer off the line.
Thanks for your call. I know test divisors have struggled with this for a long time.
They have, and especially actually at the you know, higher education or at the higher level, so the SAT and the ACT and those sorts of college admissions kinds of standards, they've long debated this issue. And, you know, as I've been saying on the show since we started, you know, I think we're seeing a testing industry that is evolving, and rightfully so. That we have to do a better job of accommodating, you know, the diversity of our cultural experience as Americans, but also make it more actionable for educators, more transparent and useful for parents and for students themselves, and on and on. And I think that's just one more way that we need to see refinement in our systems.
I don't have the figure in front of me right now, but I've read that incoming freshmen to Texas State universities have to take remedial mathematics and writing courses at really a staggering rate. Where's the disconnect between our K-12 education and acceptance into a university and the ability to succeed there?
Oh, Chris, you've hit my hot button issue. We see very significant gaps between what is required of kids in high school, even for a college-ready diploma, and what is expected of them in college. And that is something we have to attend to. You know, during my days as a secretary, the U.S. Congress passed an important enhancement to the Pell Grant, to the financial aid program for college students, that said that if kids were college ready, then they would get more money, and or if kids were studying in the STEM field, science, technology, engineering, and math, they could get more money. And we were horrified to find, pretty much across the board, that there were huge gaps in what was required for a high school diploma, even at the high levels, and what it took to be in their own state institutions. And that is something that we really have to work on, and through our higher ed coordinating boards and other ways, because you're right, we're spending a ton of money remediating kids, and we taxpayers pay twice. We're paying for kids in high school and then paying for them to have a high school education when they show up, especially at community colleges, but also at our state four-year institutions as well, especially in writing.
There's a lot of excitement around the development of some more tier one research universities in the state of Texas. Are you concerned at all that raising the profile of these places will attract a lot of students from other parts of the country and other parts of the world and make it even harder for Texas citizens to get in?
Well, you know, obviously that's a local issue that I've been less close to. I'm certainly aware of the Title I research institution discussion that's going on here. And I think, you know, we have to start looking at higher education really in different ways. You know, I think parents need to understand that, you know, starting at a community college, even if you're bound for, you know, the flagship University of Texas at Austin or Texas A&M at College Station or Tech or wherever, it's a perfectly accessible, affordable, and very fine way to get started in your education. And that, you know, knowledge and learning is really not about, you know, what city you live in and who your mascot is, but about the content of the learning, and also, of course, technology is helping us jump over all of these things too, so that you can get a USC education online. Many more institutions are putting these sorts of things out online and having high-level credentials offered in those ways. So I think we really have to shift our thinking.
Have you, I know you're familiar with the argument that perhaps we should consider giving a bachelor's degree, making it a three-year program as more students go on to postgraduate education. What do you think about that?
Well, you know, again, it's part of this whole competency-based as opposed to seat-time-based, and I am confident that we can, you know, wring out some efficiencies in terms of time if we look more around levels of education, competency, but that also requires more accountability and more transparency in higher education. And they have been quite resistant to that. And I know because I have the tire tracks on my back to show for it. But because I do believe that, you know, when you're making a decision about college, particularly something that is so important in a person's life and something so often very expensive, that we ought to know more. And, you know, having gone through this now for the second time with my own children, you know, your kid gets the feeling. I mean, you literally have more information about where you're going to eat dinner on Friday night than about the higher ed experience. What can my child expect to be able to do when they leave? You know, what are his or her prospects to pursue postgraduate education? You know, what is the relative merit of, is it a better deal to go to Ohio State and get out in 4 years, or should I go, or 5 years and get, or should I go to a more expensive private institution and get out in four? I mean, students deserve to have more kind of information and comparative information about higher education as a product, in my view.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We'll go next to Myra in Fort Worth. Hello, Myra.
Hello.
Go right ahead, please.
Okay. Well, I'm a retired teacher, and I've certainly done all the testing in Fort Worth, and now work as a consultant for Fort Worth Independent School District, and I would like to address the teacher accountability thing. And I think we all need to recognize that some kids start out on home plate and some kids start on third base. And it's just not the same in terms of what you can, the testing scores you can get with each group. Like, you can give me a group of gifted kids, and I can get, you know, 100% of the kids to pass the test. I've done it. But you look at the other kids, you know, it takes just a lot more. And so you are never going to get teachers to buy off an accountability until somehow the playing field is leveled on what, what really you're, testing for. So that is my only comment. And also that I think I work a lot with the teachers, and some teachers just spend hours and hours and hours. Our teachers, many of them, work unbelievably hours in order to produce the kind of results that they're getting if they really get good results.
Myra, thanks for your call.
Okay, thank you.
Myra, you might be surprised to hear me agree with you, and that is why now that we have now that we've arrived at the station that we're at, we can improve our accountability systems to look at growth from a beginning point to an ending point, as opposed to the absolute standard. And people who are moving the bottom up, even though you're far short of the goal, ought to be recognized and ought to get credit and ought to be, commended for that very, very difficult work that we often see. And so, yes, I think new and improved accountability systems can accommodate the phenomenon, the issue that Myra raises, and a very legitimate one.
What kind of job are we doing at educating our teachers before they ever set foot in a classroom?
Well, I think they can do a lot better. You asked about the unions, and you'll find union leaders very concerned about the kind of preparation often that our teacher colleges provide. Laura Bush, my friend, who will be introducing me tonight at SMU, a little shameless plug for Laura Bush, who's a terrific friend and a wonderful advocate for public education. She talks about her own experience and really, completely well-intended, loved kids, didn't have a clue about how to teach reading to students. And so I think, we underserve our teachers when we don't provide them the very best tools. And what I see in the field is school districts, and particularly in this area, Dallas is really a leader in this, where the teacher colleges, University of North Texas in specific, and of course I'm a huge fan of the Simmons School at SMU, are being much more customized with their school districts about what it is, the kind of population they're addressing, what the goals of the school districts are, and really tailoring pre-service education to meet the needs of the kids that they're going to be serving on the first day on the job.
Does that mean emergency certification sometimes can be a problem? Do we get teachers who know their subject but don't know how to teach as well as their peers?
Well, that's obviously, there's a million different answers to that. I mean, sometimes it works very well and sometimes less so. But I do think, if we believe that we can make, educators, if teachers can be expert on subjects, which we certainly believe that teachers can know their subject, I think we also can assume that people who are gifted in their own subjects can also be good teachers. And in fact, we need to really think more broadly about how we get people, adjuncts, if you will. I mean, higher education in America can run without adjuncts. We need subject area experts in our schools teaching kids, but we need to help them become good teachers.
Margaret Spellings is former U.S. Secretary of Education. She's in town to accept the Luminary Award from SMU's Simmons School of Education and Human Development. Margaret, thank you so much for spending the hour with
us. Thank you, Chris. It was delightful.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
The Think team includes assistant producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilufer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.
Support for KERA comes from you, our members, and from Pogo's, a unique wine and spirits boutique merchant for the past 20 years with 3 full-time wine consultants to help with your holiday needs, offering single malt whiskeys, cognac, fine wines, caviar, and champagne. Pogo's in Inwood Village.
Brennan Financial Services, independent financial advisors helping provide today's investment and retirement solutions. More at BrennanFinancialServices.com. Securities offered through FSC Securities Corporation, who is not affiliated with Brennan Financial Services.
This is your source for NPR News, KERA 90.1, Dallas-Fort Worth, Denton. Also, K261 CW 100.1 in Tyler. K202 DR 88.3 in Wichita Falls, and K257 EV 99.3 in Sherman. Think continues on KERA 90.1.
I'm Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, the twilight of the American newspaper. New American media editor Richard Rodriguez has an essay in this month's issue of Harper's on the inexorable downfall of San Francisco's two dailies and of the newspaper industry in general. Rodriguez believes that a newspaper's demise is not an indication of just a commercial enterprise going down, but an entire community's sense of place. We'll talk to him about how and why it's happening and about how a post-newspaper America might function. Our conversation begins after the news from National Public Radio.